Investiture of the Gods, Chapter 53.
And it really starts with this heavy sense of, well, exhaustion, doesn't it? This endless war.
Oh, absolutely. That opening poem just nails it. Wei River flows day and night. When will the war at Western Key cease? You feel the grind immediately.
It's like, when does this ever stop? And then straight away, that killer line, heaven's will often reversed.
Yeah, that sets the whole stage, doesn't it? Success today, disaster tomorrow. It's the core theme. Fate's just constantly messing with everyone.
And nothing screams reverse fortune louder than the event that just happened off screen, basically. The death of Grand Preceptor Wen Taishi at Zhu Longling.
Oh, that's seismic. It's not just losing a general. It's losing the general, the cornerstone, the guy King Zhu counted on for, well, everything.
He was the absolute bedrock, wasn't he? The one who could handle the regular army stuff and the weird magical threats.
Exactly. His death isn't just a morale hit. It's a strategic catastrophe. It fundamentally weakens Chaoji's ability to fight this war. Like, who steps up now?
Well, the news reaches the capital, Chaoji. And King Zi's reaction is, well, it's complicated. He's not totally shocked.
Right. The text makes a point of saying he was genuinely sad. But then he tells the court, he kind of saw it coming.
He had a dream, a vision, when Taishi reporting the loss at Deer Terrace days before the actual messenger arrived.
Yeah. Which makes you wonder, you know, if he had this heads up, what does that tell us about his leadership right now?
Is he just resigned? Like, oh, well, destiny. Or is he just bracing for impact?
I think he feels constrained. He knows powerful forces are against him, but he's still the king. He can't just give up. He has to push back, demand revenge, you know, restore face.
But his main spiritual weapon, Wen Taishi, is gone. So he needs a general fast. And he needs a win, like yesterday.
So the scramble begins. Who can possibly take over? It's a huge question.
King Zhu puts it to his grand officials, and one steps up, Grand Official Jin Sheng. He has a name.
And the recommendation is Deng Jigong. He's the total commander down at Sanshan Pass.
Right, Sanshan Pass, why him?
Well, it's kind of desperation meets competence, I think. They need someone with a recent solid win under their belt, boost morale, show things can still go right.
Ah, and Deng Jigong just beat the rebel Southern Marquis, Yishun.
Exactly. He's got that fresh victory smell. He's proven, reliable, not associated with the recent string of disasters. He looks like a safe pair of hands, maybe.
So strategically, it makes sense, but is it purely military? Or is he just the most politically acceptable guy left standing?
Probably a bit of both. He is capable. Huang Feihu confirms that later, calls him a real general.
Yeah.
But yeah, the politics are huge here. The imperial order he gets isn't exactly subtle.
No kidding. It's harsh. Crush Jifa, crush Western Key. They're accused of harboring rebels, damaging national prestige. It's serious.
And the objective is crystal clear. Capture the chief offenders, bring them back to Chaoji, presumably for a very public, very grim fate.
Deliver them as offerings at the palace gates. Wow.
And the reward, if he pulls it off. Huge. Land, nobility, the Maotu.
Yeah.
That tells you everything about how critical this mission is perceived to be. This isn't just another battle. It's the campaign to turn the tide after Wen Taishi.
Things move fast then. Deng Jigong accepts immediately, gets his forces ready.
In his crucial post at Sanshan Pass, handed over to Kongsuan. Which is a whole other story waiting to happen, but it shows they're reshuffling the deck seriously.
Okay, so Deng Jigong is the new man. The mandate is clear. The army is mobilizing. But then we get this weird little interruption.
Ah, yes. Just as things look like they might settle into a conventional military campaign, boom, enter the weirdness.
A messenger arrives. But not just any messenger. The description is so specific, so odd.
It really is. The text says he's, what, 4 or 5 feet long? Basically a dwarf.
No.
Not exactly your standard army courier profile.
Definitely not. And he's carrying a letter, an important one.
From Shen Gongbao, of course. Our favorite agent of chaos is still out there, recruiting. Remember, he was trying to convince this guy, Tu Xing Sun, to come down from his mountain retreat.
Right. So this is that guy, Tu Xing Sun, the earth-traveling immortal.
That's him. Shen Gongbao's recommendation, join Deng Jigong's campaign.
And Deng Jigong's reaction is priceless. You really see the practical general thinking here. He looks at Tu Xing Sun, the short guy, and thinks he figures badly.
Basically, this guy looks useless for army life. He sees him as a problem, not an asset.
But he's stuck, isn't he? He can't just say no, not to a recommendation from Shen Gongbao.
Exactly. Shen Gongbao has serious clout, influence with the immortals, maybe even back at court. Deng Jigong mutters, I dare not refuse this. He has to play the game. Military needs versus political reality.
So how does he handle it? He's got this unpredictable element, this potential troublemaker forced on him.
He gives him a job, a seemingly important job, but one that keeps him out of the way, hopefully. Five Army's logistics commissioner.
In charge of supplies, grain, provisions, that sort of thing.
Pretty much. Keep him busy, keep him away from the fighting troops, keep him away from strategy meetings. Respect the recommendation, but sideline the potential disruption. Deng probably hopes Tu Shingsun will just, you know, count beans quietly.
Famous last words, probably. So Tu Shingsun is tucked away in logistics. Meanwhile, who's actually on the front line with Deng?
He's got a solid team. His son, Deng Zhu, is deputy vanguard. The chief vanguard is Tai Luan. Then Zhao Sheng, Sun Yan Hong. Oh, and significantly, his daughter, Deng Chanyu. She's a warrior herself.
Right, Deng Chanyu. So it's a family affair, plus experienced officers, a proper military force.
Absolutely. And the description of them marching out, it's powerful. Flags, dust, noise. The text compares the army to a fierce tiger leaving the mountain forest. Serious business heading for Western Qi.
Okay, so fast forward about a month. They arrive, set up camp outside the east gate of Western Qi. Zhang Xian needs intel, obviously.
Yep. He asked his generals, so this Deng Jugong, what's the deal?
And Hong Fihu, who used to be Shang nobility himself, gives his assessment.
He confirms it. Deng Jugong is the real deal, a capable general.
Right.
He respects his abilities.
But Zhang Xia, he sees past the general, doesn't he? He's looking at the bigger picture.
He is. And this is where he drops that classic line, that crucial insight. Generals are easy to break. Strange arts are hard to break.
He knows the real danger isn't necessarily Deng Jugong's tactics, which, you know, you can counter with skill. It's the unpredictable stuff, the left-wing methods.
It's the Shen Gong Bao network. Zhang Xian knows more weirdness is coming. He can feel it.
And the irony is just delicious, isn't it? The biggest threat is probably the short guy currently sorting out the rations back in the Shang camp.
Totally. But first things first, you got to deal with the guy riding out to challenge you now.
Which is Tai Luan, chief vanguard. The description makes him sound pretty fierce face, like a crab, yellow beard. He rides out for the first battle, the Loon.
And the trash talk starts immediately. Tai Luan lays down the law. Western Qi are rebels, failing their duty, the usual stuff.
But Nan Gongxi, riding out for Western Qi, he doesn't just defend, he goes on the attack, verbally.
Oh yeah, he throws every single recent Shang failure right back in Tai Luan's face. When Tai Xi, dead, the Mo brothers, wiped out Zong Gifang. Defeated. It's brutal.
He basically calls Tai Luan's army grains of millet and gnats. Like, you're nothing. You're next. Talk about psychological warfare.
It definitely heats things up. So they fight. A proper duel. 30 rounds, the text says. Skill against skill.
And Nan Gongxi, maybe a bit too pumped up from his own insults, gets complacent. He underestimates Tai Luan.
Big mistake. Tai Luan isn't just some brute. He's cagey. He pulls a classic move.
A feint, right. Sells him a fake opening, Chickasee shouts to distract him.
Take that, and then strikes. Not wildly, but precisely.
He aims for the armor, the shoulder piece. Nan Gongxi jerks back, avoids getting his head taken off, but...
But the sword connects. It shears right through the shoulder armor. The Yi Sang cuts the straps clean off.
His armor is literally cut away, exposed, humiliated. The text says he fled, scared out of his wits.
It's not just a physical hit. It's a massive psychological blow. Seeing your armor, your protection, ripped off you like that. Terrifying.
Absolutely. And Deng Jugong gets it immediately. Tai Luan reports back, maybe a bit disappointed he didn't get the kill.
But Deng Jugong sees the strategic win. He says, yeah, okay, no, head on a pike, but we frustrated the spirit of the Zhu general. That first clash, Sheng victory, morale boost achieved. And Zia's initial response to the defeat, that's pure gold for anyone facing a setback, right? He offers that timeless wisdom. Victory and defeat are common to the military.
Mm-hmm. A commander must be sharp, knowing when to advance for success and when to retreat to preserve the troops. It's the ultimate keep calm and carry on moment, isn't it?
But it's underpinned by strategy.
Definitely. Strategic calculus. Zia knows how to preserve his capital, his troops, when the odds are bad. He's showing us that discipline isn't just about formation. It's about judgment.
But the judgment Zia shows the next day, that's what really seemed to hit Deng Jugong. You shared sources detailing one of the most, structured and visually overwhelming formations in the text.
Oh, absolutely. This is where Zia shows he's not just a clever general, he's a master of cosmic alignment.
So let's get into that deployment.
Okay. So when Zia deploys his forces, Deng Zhugong, the enemy general, he immediately recognizes the Zhu forces' strict discipline and their excellent mastery of tactical positioning. That's the quote.
Shendi Sing Shi Zifin.
Exactly. And this deployment, it's the five-directional array. It's the visual manifestation of the ancient Chinese concept of the five phases, or wuxing.
Okay, wait. Let's pause there for the listener. We need to really understand this wuxing idea. It's not just picking colors for the uniforms, is it?
No, absolutely not. The wuxing system, you know, wood, fire, earth, metal, water, it's like a cosmological map. Each element governs not only a direction and a color, but also a season, a temperament, specific military tactics, too.
So Zia is using this structure.
He's signaling to his educated enemies, people like Deng Zhugong, that his army is aligned with cosmic order itself. It kind of elevates the conflict, you know, beyond just fighting over land.
That makes the whole layout much more compelling. Okay, let's walk through the array then. Connect the wuxing logic to the actual tactics and weapons. We start with the front line, right? South.
That's the most aggressive point, the south. It's aligned with the element of fire, symbolized by the vermilion bird, the Zhuk.
M.E. the red.
Right, red flags, red uniforms. Fire is heat, expansion, rapid charge, so that's why you have the Iron Cavalry vanguard there.
Okay, but I'm struggling with one detail the source mentions. That poetic warning, vermilion bird faces the front, all things tend to misfortune. Why would Zia put an ill omen right at the point of attack? Is that like psychological warfare?
That's a really interesting point. It feels like realism woven into the strategy, doesn't it? Fire is powerful, yeah, but it's also volatile. It consumes itself quickly.
Ah, so he's acknowledging the risk.
I think so. Zia is acknowledging the danger inherent in the vanguard. It's the point of maximum engagement, but also maximum exposure. He's putting his most explosive, but maybe most vulnerable element right where it needs to be to break the enemy line. But he knows the potential cost.
Shows a commander who understands sacrifice. High risk. High reward. Okay, moving to the wings. The left, or east, that's wood, the azure dragon, King Long, marked by blue or green flags.
Exactly. Wood is associated with spring, growth, flexibility, and look at the weaponry here. Short swords and long spears.
Or agile.
Yeah, it speaks to agility, close quarters fighting, versatility, lets them adapt quickly, and the mention of the Zen Palace and a fire attack also suggests, you know, they're ready to shift from skirmishing to something more destructive if needed.
Got it. Now, the mirror image, the right, or west, that's the white tiger by Hugh. West is aligned with metal, and the clanners are white.
Right. And metal governs hardness, sharpness, defense. Think autumn's harvest, protecting resources. So this section is heavily fortified. It leans into ranged power. Spears, halberds, strongbows, crossbows.
They're the anchor.
The defensive anchor, yeah. Meant to repel attacks with sheer volume of fire.
And this is where we get that cryptic reference, that little strategic Easter egg. Dunjia. What exactly is Dunjia?
Oh, Dunjia. It's short for Kimin Dunjia. It's an ancient, really complex system, part divination, part strategic calculation.
Calculation?
Yeah, it involves analyzing time, direction, astronomical alignments, all to figure out the absolute best movement for troops, the most auspicious action. By mentioning it here, the text is hinting, this isn't just a static wall of troops.
And so the White Tiger unit is calculating.
Constantly calculating the optimal moment, the best trajectory for defense for counterattack. It's the unit of hidden, calculated complexity.
Wow. No wonder Deng Zhugong was impressed. He's looking at an army that's not just organized, but like mathematically and cosmologically perfect.
It really is something.
Okay, finally, the rear, the north, aligned with water, the black tortoise, Xuanwu, black flags.
Right. Water is about flow, support, depth. The north is the anchor, the reserve. Their purpose is explicitly support and flanking.
Zhu Yu Yuying.
Exactly. And their weapons, whips, maces, hammers, they're heavy, stabilizing. Perfect for stopping a flanking move or delivering a crushing counterblow when the enemy is weak.
And overseeing all this perfect geometric power, the center, Zia's command post, anchored by the apricot yellow flag.
That's the element of earth. Stability, the center point, control. Zia, riding his mythical Sebuxiang mount, surrounded by 24 golden-armored generals. It's less like a tent, more like a geometric, almost impregnable fortress. The level of detail in Zia's prep, it's stunning.
Yeah.
Even before a sword is drawn.
So Zia lays out this perfect cosmic formation. Impressive stuff. But the question is, what impressed Ding Zhugong more, the geometry or maybe the political implications of this perfect order? Because once the array was set, the fighting didn't start with blades, did it?
No, it started with words. It was almost a necessary pause. In classical Chinese warfare, you had to establish moral superiority. Legitimacy was huge.
Ding Zhugong represented the established Shang dynasty.
Exactly. He couldn't just fight. He had to try and destroy the moral foundation of the Zhou rebellion first.
Right. So Deng confronts Xia, praises the visual strategy, but then goes straight for the jugular, loyalty-wise.
Mm-hmm. His core argument is rooted in Confucian morality Gang Cheng, the proper hierarchy, the duties of a subject. He calls Xia a disloyal traitor, Panguo. He asks why a revered Kunlun mountain scholar, someone who should know better, would abandon his duty.
Framing the Zhou rebellion as moral chaos.
Precisely. And demanding surrender to stop the suffering of all the people. It's a powerful play. Loyalty to the old order protects everyone.
That is a powerful argument. How does Xia possibly counter something like that?
Well, Xia just laughs. He dismisses the whole speech as like a fool speaking in a dream, Qiren Shuming. He doesn't even bother defending his personal loyalty.
So what does he do?
He pivots. He appeals to a higher authority, the mandate of heaven, and historical precedent.
Ah, arguing that the world has basically already moved on.
Exactly. He states it flat out. The world now supports the Zhou, and popular opinion follows suit. Tiangxia Gizhu ranks in Shaoshun. He reminds Deng that Shang has already been beaten badly in previous campaigns. Generals captured, armies wiped out.
He's saying your moral framework is nice, but heaven has chosen a new ruler, and history proves your cause is lost.
Pretty much. Your loyalty is admirable, maybe, but you're backing the wrong horse, the losing side of destiny.
And then he gives Deng that stark choice. Retreat and report Zhou's legitimacy, or fight and end up like Wen Taishi.
Oof, yeah. Wen Zong. That's a direct threat. Comparing him to the famously defeated high-ranking general Wen Taishi is meant to break Deng's will.
A historical threat.
And that comparison, calling Wen Taishi, that's the tipping point. It reminds Deng that all his skill, all his loyalty, it didn't save previous commanders from this exact fate. This is when the political war just fails.
And the physical war begins.
Instantly. Deng is enraged, especially, apparently, at being called a villager, a kung fu. He just attacks Xia immediately.
But Xia's protected, right? The duels just explode. Organized chaos erupts around the command center.
Yeah, Huang Feihu, the Wusheng Wang, he charges in on his five-colored divine ox to intercept Deng. Knife against spear, fierce blows traded right away.
And Deng calls Huang Feihu a traitor.
A fanzai, the worst kind, a turncoat from within Shang ranks, which just highlights the deep personal bitterness here, you know. Reinforces the political stakes even in the middle of the fight.
And the battlefield just spreads out. A structured melee. Generals against generals.
Ne Zha jumps in to help Huang Feihu. Deng Zhu, Deng Zhugong's son, he's met by Huang Tianhua on the Jade Kirin. Then you have Tai Luan versus Wu Ji, Zhao Sheng against Tai Dian, Sen Yan Hong versus Huang Tianlu. It's a massive, desperate fight. The text says it darkened the sky and earth. Tian Hun Dian.
So this is where it shifts, isn't it? From Xia's perfect, disciplined, earthly array.
To the element that actually decides the day. Divine intervention. Magic. Despite the tactical perfection of the Zhou formation, the individual duels, they aren't ultimately won by better positioning or, you know, superior spear work.
That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ne Zha sees Ding Zhugong holding his own.
And decides to just bypass the martial struggle altogether. He uses his magical weapon, the Qiong Kun Circle, Qing Kun Quan.
Throws it.
Hits Ding Zhugong right on the left arm. Devastating force. The source says skin broken and muscle torn. Dai Duan Pikai. It nearly knocks Ding Zhugong right off his horse. One magical hit almost takes out the enemy commander.
And it wasn't just Ne Zha using magic.
No. In another duel, Zhao Sheng uses this specific innate power. He just opens his mouth and spits out several feet of fire. Penchu Tichu Wo Lai.
Elemental power, just like that.
Exactly. Applied directly. Instantly takes Tai Dian out of the fight. Leaves him scorched on the face and head, Jar Tulane. Badly burned.
So the magic is decisive.
Completely. The fighting is just too fierce, too chaotic to sustain. Both sides pull back. But the result's clearly in Zhou's favor. Deng Zhugong gets back to camp in agony from his arm, can't even rest properly. Tai Dian is out of action, sent back to recover from the burns. Xia's perfectly structured army. It gained its edge from the spiritual power of his allies.
Deng Zhugong, he's been seriously injured. You'd expect, you know, a mighty general or maybe a seasoned lieutenant to step up for revenge.
Right, the usual suspects.
But the person who volunteers is his daughter, Deng Xianyu, and the text actually calls her a deep chamber, weak quality woman.
It's just the ultimate subversion of expectation, like built right into her description. And Zia, the seasoned strategist, he immediately recognized the danger here. Our sources highlight his instant caution.
His caution.
Yeah. Noting that in warfare, he had three types of opponents he truly feared. Taoists, 202, which means the bald-headed, so usually Buddhist figures, and Funu, women.
Okay, wait.
Yeah.
Why lump those three groups together? What makes them the ultimate strategic threat in his eyes?
Well, because Zia was sort of paranoid about, let's call it military ethics or maybe heterodoxy. These groups, in his mind anyway, they didn't fight by the established rules of engagement.
Mm-hmm.
They relied on what he called evil arts or, you know, unconventional methods, Shishu. They just brought this unpredictability that made standard cavalry and formation tactics, well, almost irrelevant.
Okay.
Zia knew his generals, who relied mostly on conventional brute force and maybe some magic artifacts. They would really struggle against tactics they just couldn't immediately categorize or counter.
And we see the paranoia justified pretty much instantly.
Yeah.
Because the first general to just dismiss Zia's warning and step forward is the fiery and intensely arrogant Meza.
Oh, Neja treats the caution almost like a joke. He volunteers immediately, and his attitude towards Chenyu is pure, unfiltered contempt. It's quite striking.
What does he say?
Well, when he sees her, he starts shouting insults, calls her a five limbs incomplete woman, and explicitly shames her for not following family teaching, accuses her of shameless exposure just by, you know, showing up on the battlefield.
Wow.
Yeah. This dismissal, it's the crack she immediately exploits.
But before she proves him completely wrong, we have to appreciate the profound irony that's baked right into the source material's description of Deng Xianyu herself.
Oh, absolutely. She's presented as both the ideal of feminine beauty and, at the same time, the complete opposite of domesticity.
How so?
Well, the source praises her appearance, notes she has red silk wrapped around her phoenix hairpin, and crucially, it mentions her narrow golden lotuses.
Which refers to foot binding, right? A marker of confinement.
Exactly. A physical marker of domestic confinement, refined beauty at the time. Yet, look at her actions. The text says she's eager to brandish a sword instead of sewing and lazy to stand by the dressing table, preferring to ride her fierce war horse.
So she is, quite literally, the kind of woman as it assumes she is in terms of appearance, but embodied in the warrior he completely refuses to see.
Perfectly put. That dual identity sets up her brilliant and really deceptively simple strategy.
Tell us about the strategy.
It's magnificent misdirection.
Yeah.
Relies entirely on the ego of her opponent, Neza, in this case. She engages him briefly, just long enough to confirm his prejudice that she's a weak opponent.
Okay.
Then she feigns panic and retreats, shouting, "I am not as good as you, Wu Wujini."
Playing right into his expectations.
Totally. Neza, absolutely convinced that a woman does not endure large battles, sees this as an immediate victory. He foolishly chases her, thinking he's going for an easy, decisive kill.
And here's the core of the problem for Zia's side. Neza, chasing for glory, runs headlong into the ultimate unconventional weapon.
The five-colored stone.
Oh.
The Wuguan Shi. See, Shanyu doesn't need some giant magical blade or a fancy divine artifact.
Mm-hmm.
No. She just turns back, takes the small, precise projectile, and throws it. Bang! Hits Neza square in the face.
Ouch.
Yeah, the text describes him retreating in utter disarray, his powdered face turning this hideous blue and purple, his nose and eyes flatten. It even says immortals are forced to frown after being hit by this thing.
The physical damage is only half of it, though. The psychological damage, the public humiliation,
mm-hmm.
That's critical here.
Absolutely. And who rushes in immediately to rub salt in the wound?
Let me guess, his own teammate.
Yep. Huang Tianhua. The infighting is almost the best part of the drama here.
What does he do?
Tianhua immediately starts mocking Neza, jokes that the injury might have broken his appearance, Po Lixiang, and suggests this whole thing is basically cursed.
So petty.
It is. And it's important for you to realize that Tianhua's main motivation for fighting next, it isn't loyalty to Zia, it's not strategic recovery.
It's ego.
It's driven purely by the fear of continued mockery from Neza. He doesn't want Neza laughing at him anymore.
So Tianhua goes out, fueled by ego and peer pressure. And we see the start of what you could almost call the curse of broken noses.
It's an immediate, just disastrous failure of adaptation on their part. Tianhua vows to fight, and the sequence of events is, well, it's virtually identical to Neza's defeat.
You're kidding. The exact same thing.
Pretty much. He engages, she feigns flight, he chases the text, explicitly says he's thinking, if I don't pursue her, I'll be mocked again, and then she turns back and throws a stone.
I have to stop you there. This is where I find Zia's leadership, or maybe the team dynamics, really perplexing. We know Zia is supposed to be this brilliant strategist.
Right.
Yet the source seems to imply he didn't just halt the line and say, okay, stop, new plan. After the first general got hit like that, was his authority just, I don't know, overridden by the sheer hubris of these heroes?
I think that's really the crux of the issue. Zia's wisdom warns them about the unconventional threat, right? But the culture of the general staff, the arrogance of these powerful figures, it overrides tactical discipline.
They just couldn't believe it.
They dismiss the source of the danger, the weak quality woman, rather than adapting to the method of the danger, which is the stone. And Tiano pays for it big time.
And his damage is described as being far worse than Nez's, wasn't it?
Significantly worse, yeah. She hits him so hard that the description notes she broke the bridge of the nose, Dudwan Shingen.
Okay.
And that carries this additional layer of mythic consequence. It's a curse of 100 years of bad luck. So this wasn't just a physical injury. It was like a mark of shame and real ill fate.
Wow. And the irony then comes full circle, doesn't it? Nezha, the original victim, now nursing his own flattened, discolored face.
He gets the immediate satisfaction of throwing Tianhua's exact previous words right back at him.
What does he say?
A general must, I observe, four directions. Ear, listen, eight sides, Nezha retorts, basically mocking Tianhua's lack of awareness.
Unbelievable.
This petty personal squabble just confirms that both generals were way too focused on internal politics and their own perceived superiority to notice a consistent, deadly tactic being used against them. Zia finally had to step in, not really to plot strategy, but just to break up the locker room infighting.
Okay, so the team finally, belatedly, realizes their brute strength and conventional magical weapons are just irrelevant against this level of precision projectile.
Right. They need a specialized defense.
They need a counter-projectile specialist.
Exactly. And that's when Yang Jian recommends the really bizarre, truly unconventional solution for what becomes the ultimate test. Long Zuhu, the dragon whisker tiger.
You mentioned he's one of the strangest characters in the entire text. Tell us more about this anti-stone specialist.
Oh, Long Suhu is physically just a creature of pure mythic chaos. The source goes into vivid detail. He has hands like a falcon, feet like a tiger, a body that moves like a slick fish, and whiskers described like a shrimp's.
Okay, that's unusual.
Definitely. He's an ancient being tied to cloud water, and Destiny says he has to aid Zia. He's basically a literal manifestation of unconventional warfare brought in to fight the unconventional.
And there's that fascinating meta detail about his destiny, too, isn't there? Something about the list.
Yes. The source pointedly notes he has no name on the investiture of the gods list. Fenshin Bang Shanwu Mingxing. He's not a standard hero, not a standard immortal.
He's an outsider.
The ultimate outsider, yeah. Brought in precisely because the standard heroes have failed so spectacularly. He's kind of the only one Zia's team can put forward who might understand or at least counter the unconventional method.
So Long Zuhu tries to overwhelm Chanyu's precision with just pure, terrifying volume. It becomes a battle of the stones, but like different kinds of stones.
It's finesse versus monster brute force. Absolutely. Long Zuhu immediately opens fire with his own projectile attack, throwing stones the size of grinding stones, Mo Pendashao.
Huge ones.
Massive. They fall like flying locusts or thunderbolts, creating this overwhelming barrage. The whole idea is just to destroy the smaller weapon and maybe the wielder with sheer mass and chaos.
But once again, Shan Yu's finesse wins out. She doesn't get hit.
She's a master of situational awareness. She skillfully dodges the barrage, and she realizes that even if the massive stones miss her, they're still dangerous if they hit her horse.
Good point.
So what does she do? She feigns retreat. And Long Zuhu, despite being this bizarre ancient creature, commits the exact same error as the generals before him.
No, he chases her.
He chases, tries to capitalize on what he thinks is fear or retreat.
And she delivers the most precise, perfect shot yet in this whole sequence.
Absolutely textbook. Long Zuhu sees the stone coming, and because of his bizarre physiology, he ducks his head down to avoid it. But his unusually long, exposed neck leaves a perfect, vulnerable target. The stone hits him precisely on the back of the neck, the Jingzi Wurgu, basically the neck hollow bone, twists it severely. Then a second stone strikes his unique footing, causing him to lose balance and fall, leaving him completely vulnerable for capture. Just like that.